The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this January 1st, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Writers on Writing. And as always, we're inviting you to write in with your thoughts, especially in the new year. Maybe you have thoughts on the show of what you've loved, what you'd like more of, what you'd like less of. We love to hear it all. You can write to Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net. You can write to me at mariestone@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. And I am your host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, even on New Year's morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We are doing it in the new year, in a new decade, which may mean new resolutions for you about writing or about reading. Whatever they are, we wish you success. So we're devoting the whole hour this morning of our first show of the new year, the new decade, to poetry. Michael Miller released a 20-year retrospective of his poems way back in 2019. It's called TN Subtitles, Selected Poems from 1999 to 2019. Many of them are about beginnings, even New Year's Day itself. There's one New Year's Day in Laguna Beach for our Orange County listeners. And I'd hoped we would have had time to read the New Year's Day poems, but this gives you an added excuse to pick up the collection, which is wonderful. So there's a lot in there. Michael Miller is a former entertainment journalist for the LA Times. He's the author of Thief After Dark, which came out in 2002, College Town in 2010, The First Thing Mastered in 2013, and Angels in Seven in 2016. A two-time Pushcart Prize nominee, he won the 2014 Orange County Press Club Award for his story on poets Lee Mallory and Charles Bukowski. He earned his BA in English right here at UCI and an MA in Creative Writing from the University of East Anglia. Michael teaches English at Our Lady of Lourdes Parish School in Northridge. He was on the show with me in 2014 for his collection, The First Thing Mastered. You can find a copy of that podcast in our archives and on my website, mariestone.com. But it's his latest, TN Subtitles, Selected Poems from 1999 to 2019, published this last July by Moontide Press, that we are talking about today. Michael lives in L.A., but he drove down to see me. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Marie. It's good to be back.
Thanks for coming on. So because we have the luxury of time, I would love to hear your origin story, not only into poetry, but into writing itself and sort of how the poetry came about.
Well, I would say I grew up in an artistic family. There are all different kinds of families. There are political families. There are sports families. My family was all about arts and literature. My dad was an art professor. My mom taught English at Fullerton College. And so the genes kind of went in two ways. My brother became a visual artist. I became a writer. None of us can sing or dance. So we're not performing artists, but we're artists of the other kind.
So you and you studied English when you were here.
I did, yes. I had a BA in English at UCI.
Okay. And so writing was your plan all the way along?
I would say if you can have a plan when you're 5 years old, I guess you just kind of hit a groove and you never stop.
Yeah,
when I was little, I would make up poems, I'd make up stories, I'd make up songs. It always came naturally. And what I find is even if you think something comes natural to you, you still have to keep honing that talent. You still have to keep challenging yourself. And so I have a great many people to thank for this book that we're talking about here today.
Yeah. So tell me about the early poems. Were you writing when you were really little, writing poetry, playing around with it?
Playing around is probably the key word. I really wrote songs and stories more than poems. I didn't really write something that I considered a real official poem until I was a senior in high school. And believe it or not, that poem is in this book. It's called Elegy for a Rhythm Guitarist. I wrote it during the spring of 1998 when I was a senior at high school. And then when I was a freshman at UCI, I entered that in a poetry contest at the UCI bookstore, and it won second place. It got published that spring in Faultline, which is the UCI literary magazine. So on the cover of this book, it says Selected Poems 1999 to 2019. That's the 1999 right there.
I love it.
For several years, in fact, that was my only poem. I would go to poetry readings, and that was all that I had. I remember one time I actually came to a reading. I read a different poem, and as I was sitting down, someone said, "Whoa, I thought I was going to hear the guitar guy again." So, yes, I finally did come up with another poem.
It must be interesting as you look at the collection as a whole now. So it's 20 years of poetry. Mm-hmm. And as you look back on that poem in particular, does it even feel like you anymore? Like, do you recognize yourself in it?
Well, you know, the writer Sandra Cisneros, she has a famous story where she talks about a girl turning 11. And she says, "What you don't realize is that when you're 11, you're also 10, and you're also 9, and you're also 8. In all those previous years, you still have somewhere inside you." So when I look at that poem, Elegy for a Rhythm Guitarist, yeah, it's definitely me. It's the 18-year-old version of me. But again, you never completely shed that person that you used to be. So yeah. It's a poem that I'm very fond of. I think I've definitely written better, more sophisticated poems in the 20 years since then, but I have a lot of affection for it, so I was very happy. I kind of unearthed it for this book. It hadn't seen the light of day in almost 20 years, but I thought, you know, that really is where the story begins, so there's no sense having a book like this and leaving that first one out.
Now I feel like we have to read it.
Okay.
Do you read it?
I'm happy to read it, yes.
Love it.
Okay, so Elegy for a Rhythm Guitarist. The last thing you hear is a soft chord in A, ringing under the bass at the end of the song. Then a small bit of talk, with the tape running on. But not in his voice. He had sauntered away. He muttered, "See you." We nodded our heads. He slipped out the door, past the bricks and the shed, and squinted his eyes at the day. That was 5 years ago, just a day in July. He pulled up to the house and slid out of his car with his clothes all disheveled, but he had his guitar, and he fingered it softly with blanks in his eyes. In a suburb garage with a tape and some drums, I sang with Brigitte while he sat down and strummed a few chords, and the hour passed by. The story's well known, how they tracked down his car, smashed apart in a ditch, with his sunglasses snapped, and the packet of joints come apart on his lap. 10 feet from the window, his broken guitar, which he'd held like a crutch, his eyes red behind shades, through those wandering sessions on long, muggy days, cigarettes and the trips to the bar. A gifted musician, I can't say I knew him that well, aside from the notes that he played. Just a friend of a friend. He'd stop by on those days when the world was stalling. We'd strum a few tunes, and he'd light up a joint and then blink at the sun, while he hammered the chords, hard and fast, one by one, as the microphones buzzed in the room. He had his own troubles, drugged out and remote, a high school dropout, a shell of a man at the end of his life, but he sure had the hands. And when he blacked out at the side of the road, the papers that noticed it mentioned his skills, how he taught himself nicely before he was killed. I think I may still have the quote. The garage is long gone. I don't live in that town anymore, though I still sometimes talk to Brigitte, in the house where she still lives, a bit down the street. The tapes that we made then are lying around my apartment in piles, except for the one from that very last session when we let the tape run, for I still haven't shaken that sound. First a roll of the drums, then the bass wanders in, and the voices flare up, but right there in the back is the soft chime of strings and the last artifact. Just a few broken notes, like the drop of a pin in the balance of time right before the thread snaps. When things fall apart and the last word is trapped like a ghost in the form of a string.
Mm. That stands up 20 years later.
Thank you.
That's incredible.
Thank you very much.
It must be weird now that you're a father yourself to look back at ages that your child isn't at yet, but you know, you can see what's coming, and obviously your areas of concern as a man and as a poet and a writer have to obviously change, but
they all coincide, believe me. What I tell my students is that you can't grow as a poet without growing as a person. I mean, your poetry, and probably your art of any kind, whatever the medium is, just reflects your wisdom and your experience and what you've learned, you know, in the course of your lifetime. So, you know, a poem that you write when you're 15, it is the wisdom of a 15-year-old, and that's just what makes it different from, you know, what a 3-year-old might write, what a 35-year-old might write. These are just the notes that you leave as you're taking that journey of life. So, I mean, my daughter right now is not writing poems yet, but she is making up little phrases. Sometimes she'll take a song from a movie and she'll swap a couple of words, kind of adapt it to her life. So we get little glimpses of that thinker, at least, whether or not she ends up being an actual poet.
Yeah. So. And, you know, the other thing about youth, I mean, you don't have the concept of cliche and you don't have idioms, and so they come up with the most incredible things. Mm-hmm. And a teenager comes up with, you know, you never have the passion or you never have the firsts that you experience as a teenager, mm-hmm. that you experience with sort of the ferocity or, you know, whatever that teenagers experience, love and alcohol and drugs and all these things, you know. So there, I think there is something really to be said for writing at all those ages, even if it's not mature or sophisticated. It's, mm-hmm. it's got something else that is harder to capture when you're 50, you know.
There is. And I mean, so many artists, it's interesting if you look at a lot of different artists, some of them do their best work when they're young. I mean, in some ways they are naive, they're immature, but their work is never as dazzling as it is when they're 18, 20, 25. And then you have others who just blossom when they're much older than that. Like Paul Simon, to me, is a classic mm-hmm. example. You listen to his early work with Simon and Garfunkel, it's not that it's bad, but you can tell it's the work of a very young person. And then you get later on, you get into Graceland and The Rhythm of the Saints and some of his later albums. And, you know, again, you hear the person growing, not just the artist. You know, you just see how his horizons broaden so much with time. And for me, he's a great example of an artist who really got better as he aged, whereas some really do peak early and then just kind of spend the rest of their career trying to recapture whatever that something was that they had early on.
Right. Yeah. Keep trading on, yeah, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So your decision with the English degree was to go into journalism, which I assume was more of an economic decision than a creative decision.
Believe it or not, the two kind of went hand in hand. I started working at the LA Times the summer after high school. I had been the co-editor of the high school paper. I won a journalism contest that was sponsored by the LA Times. And so actually, literally 2 months to the day after I graduated, this is from Sonora High School in La Habra, I got a call from the calendar editor asking me to come in and do 20 hours of desk work a week. This is like doing the calendar listings, writing little blurbs here and there. So I was actually working at the LA Times before I even started at UCI. During the 4 years I was an undergrad, I did both. I would work 20 to 40 hours a week at the Times. I'd do a story here and there. And then the rest of the time it was just, you know, doing the work for a BA in English. So yeah, it was intense. It was a very, you know, intensive 4 years. Yeah, but yeah. I certainly learned a lot from doing it.
So the poetry kind of always rippled along the side of that as a passion?
Pretty much, yeah. For most people, poetry, it kind of ripples along the side whether you want to or not. I mean, yeah you're not going to make Beyoncé's salary being a poet, unfortunately. So, you know, for some people, they get to teach poetry for a living, which I kind of do. But, yeah, I mean, it's a kind of art where you're definitely going to need to have a day job of some kind to support it. But the nice thing about poetry is it really costs nothing. You just need a pen and paper or computer, whatever it is you work on. And you kind of set your own pace as to when you're able to work on it. So as side projects go, it's a very easy one to have.
Yeah.
So you're always able to find time. I mean, amazing poems have been written in 5 minutes. Amazing poems have been written in 2 years. So, you know, every poem just kind of takes its own path. And sometimes you just kind of sit down and everything falls right in place. And
we had Grant Heyer was on fairly recently, and mm-hmm. he had given himself a challenge. I don't know if April, is April National Poetry Month?
Yes, April
okay.
is National Poetry
so,
Month.
So during the month of April, he had given himself a challenge that he was going to write a poem every day.
Mm-hmm.
And at first he was, you know, because he claims to be a fairly slow writer. And mm-hmm. he said, you know, once I had that challenge, I would dictate it into a phone on my drive home. I'd write on scraps of paper while I was sitting at lunch. You know, you find the time. Mm-hmm. And I liked that idea of giving yourself sort of the challenge of a poem a day. Mm-hmm. It didn't have to be great, you know, sure. It wasn't a finished poem, but...
Yeah, I definitely know people who have done that, so I never have myself, but yeah, it's 30 days in April, so yeah, I've seen, like, on Facebook, they say, here's day 28 of the 30-poem challenge, and yeah, they do come up with some really good stuff that way.
Yeah, I guess it's the equivalent of the National Novel Writing Month for novelists, right, in November. It's way easier to write a poem in 30 days than it is to write a novel in 30 days. But
didn't Dostoevsky do it?
I think he did. I think he did. Have you found that the journalism helps your poet? I ask this question because I find that when I'm working on nonfiction, it really impacts my fiction in a negative way. Hmm. It really kind of strips the voice out of what I'm trying to do creatively when I'm writing articles. And I was wondering if you struggle with that as well, or if you can really compartmentalize and separate the two.
Personally, I've never found that being a journalist had a negative effect on poetry. Now, I haven't worked as a journalist now in a few years, but a couple of ways that I found journalism actually helped poetry is, number one, you have to start with the good stuff. In journalism, they talk about hooks and leads and, you know, that first paragraph being so crucial. There was actually a poem that's in this book called The Leader where I was struggling, you know, many, many times with how to begin that poem. It's a poem that tells a little miniature story. You know, there are a few characters and there's a scene, but I remember just going through one draft after another, and however I started it, it never felt right. And so finally, I think I just asked myself, okay, if I were writing this for the newspaper, how would I begin it? What would my hook be? Hmm. I think when I actually slipped into that mentality, I was able to find the opening for the poem. So that's one. Yeah, starting with, you know, a strong opening is one thing. And then also just clarity. I'm one of those people, and I think we talked about this last time, I'm not really a fan of inaccessible poetry. I think you owe it to your reader to at least give them something they can follow. If they have a few questions about it, that's fine, that's par for the course in poetry. But the way I approach writing a poem is, if my reader is going to have any questions, I want them to at least know what questions to ask. You know, what does that animal symbolize, or, you know, how are we supposed to feel about the narrator in this poem? You know, an actual question they can articulate is fine. But to me, if the reader is looking at a poem and just thinking, is this English? I can't tell. Am I holding the paper upside down? To me, at least if one of my poems comes off that way, I feel like I've failed the reader. So to me, clarity is a virtue in poetry, and I think being a journalist does help with that.
I wonder if it makes sense to read the poem you're talking about.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
You used,
The Leader. Yeah, yeah. This is... Again, this book, Tea and Subtitles, this is a selected poems collection. These are 50 poems that came out in the last 20 years. And this one originally came out in the book, The First Thing Mastered, which you and I talked about
right.
5 years ago on the show. The First Thing Mastered, you know, we were talking about ages and wisdom. It's a collection of poems that move chronologically through about the first 3 decades of life.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with infancy, and it goes into kind of the years right before middle age. So this poem, The Leader, this is in the section of poems about childhood. So it's a poem about a group of kids, and I don't want to say too much more about the story because the poem will speak for itself. But this is about that time of life where we're thinking more and more about the choices we make and the kind of person that we want to be. So I'll go ahead and read the poem. Mm-hmm. This is called The Leader. His hand has lifted, and it will give the cue again. This heat-shot afternoon outside the arcade, where the girl who stammers pie digits on the bus grins 10 feet behind them with tokens spread in her palm. He catches himself, his hand shot up unknowing, a gesture that started somewhere on its own. His fingers poised to swat the girl away or motion inward for her to join. He does not love her, but more and more, his eyes run to catch the outliers. The woman with the mad fluorescent feathers who paints portraits in minutes outside the subway. The man in the wheelchair who shouts, "Jesus be with you!" and races the walkers to the curb and back. Mozart on the headphones, and Kahlo mustachioed by the museum. So much brilliance on this block. But here on the sidewalk, the other eyes fix him, their slow squints pressing to keep the tribe intact. Is the greatest achiever the one who flails alone, or the one who perfects the step in time? Now his eyes scowl, and he brings his fingers in, the girl with a blush trotting into their circle, the others staring, but parting to make room. This moment, his victory. Yes, his victory. The power of his voice, a note deeper than the others. His face with stubble, half a head above theirs. While they shout over joysticks, he slouches in the corner. Silent type. The one slick enough to tilt the day with his hand.
I wish people could watch you read it, because even your hand gestures are wonderful as you're reading it. You're either kind of keeping beat with it, or you're making the gestures that are made in the poem. It's really lovely. It's really lovely.
Thank you.
So talk a little bit about finding the, you know, as you were saying, you were trying to figure out how you would structure this as a journal article, and what the door in was, and how to begin it. So talk a little about that process.
Yeah, so I mean, the scene, you have this group of boys, there's one who's taller than the others, he's kind of the leader, the one they look up to. There's a girl, what it says about her in the poem is she stammers pie digits on the bus. You can kind of read whatever into that you want to, but obviously she's a girl who's kind of an outsider in some way. And so she wants to play with them. She's come here, she has the tokens in her palm, she wants to go to the arcade with him. The other boys are kind of looking up at the tall one and thinking, you know, no, you know, this is our group, don't let her join. And what he realizes is, when he saw the girl, his hand just shot up. He didn't realize he had done it, but now his hand is in a position, he can either beckon inward, like, come on, join us, or he can do the little swatting motion, like, get away, you know, you're not one of us, you're not in our group. And so the leader finds himself caught, his hand is in the air, and he knows, with, you know, whatever way he moves his hand, he's either going to cave into peer pressure and get rid of the girl, or he's going to do what he knows is the right thing and include her. And so, in terms of how to begin the story, I was beginning with the backstory. I was beginning by talking about the other boys, kind of talking about the weather. I think I tried everything but what I eventually did. So finally I thought, well, you know, the whole poem centers around his hand. I mean, his hand is shot up in the air, and he has to decide what gesture to make with it. So I thought, how about if I just begin with the words, his hand, and that begins the poem. His hand is lifted, and then those words, his hand, they're the last two words of the poem as well. So it circles back to that same image. But starting that way, I thought it would be a little more suspense. You have this image of the hand going up in the air, and then right away you want to know, well, you know, why did he do that? Who is he? So then the scene just kind of fills in after that. So anyway, I hope it works. I mean,
it's really wonderful.
I hope it works. Somebody published it, so yeah, at least one other person thought it was a good lead.
It is a wonderful lead.
Thank you.
And do you take on, Barbara talks about this with poets a lot, the idea of the persona, and whether or not you take on different personas as you're writing these poems, or if you, you know, I think it's easy for people to hear a poem, especially non-writers, to hear a poem and say, this must have happened to Michael when he was in high school on the bus, which obviously, you know, writers know is not the case. So do you feel yourself in these poems taking on either the role of your own self, who's a different self now, 20 years removed, mm-hmm. or wholly different people?
It really varies. Some poems are literally word for word true to life. There's a couple in this book I can think of that are completely true stories. A lot of them, they're kind of somewhere in the middle. A lot of the time, I'll sit down and start writing about something that really happened to me, and then the poem kind of takes on its own shape as you write it. So you start adding this little detail or this little, what it can be a color, it can be a word that somebody says, and then gradually it starts becoming more and more a work of fiction. So I would say most often they're poems that are what did Mark Twain say in Huckleberry Finn? Mostly true with some stretchers. So kind of mostly true with some stretchers. There are some that are completely fiction, like persona poems. Yeah, in this book, for sure, there's some written in the first person that are in no way related to real life, like Elegy for a Rhythm Guitarist. That one is completely a fictional story. But there are others in here that are really word for word true to life, so it doesn't
matter. Are the ones that are really true to life written fairly contemporaneously with the event that you're writing about, or do you let time pass?
I would say generally they're very close to the event itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like there's one, for example, called Alaska Airlines Nonstop to LAX. This is second to last poem in the book. And really, every personal detail in that poem is true. I was actually on an Alaska Airlines flight going to LAX, and I wrote it there in the seat, and all the things that are mentioned in the poem, like the in-flight movie and the clouds outside the window, that was a case of just looking around, kind of being like a painter and just, or maybe being a journalist, just taking down everything that you see around you. Do you know Lowell Yeager? He's the poet laureate of Montana. I invited him as a guest poet. We do Skype visits with poets sometimes in class. Mm. And he has a poem called Fishburger and Fries. And it's a poem about sitting at McDonald's and eating a fishburger and fries and just looking around at all the other people. And we did an exercise in class with that poem. Lowell talked a little about how really he was sitting there in McDonald's. There's his fishburger. He's just writing about all the people he saw. And so we ended up having the students do an exercise where they kind of acted as a fly on the wall. You know, they could do it right there in the classroom or maybe outside at the mall, wherever it was. But we told them, just plant yourself somewhere, write down everything you see. And sometimes that's the poem. I mean, sometimes what you write down can be more interesting and more profound than you might have imagined. So, there's definitely something to be said for that kind of writing.
Yeah. Do you want to read Alaska Airlines?
I would love to. Alaska Airlines Nonstop to LAX. Before the planes turned to ram the Twin Towers, they hummed in a straight line just like this. An achievement always to stay calm facing forward, and most remarkable when wings and circuits keep us suspended over a space too vast to be even called a drop. The sky that radiates blue from below turns to nothing when looked at from above. But here on board, we cling to the somethings we have. Water closer to us in the plastic bottles than in the particles of clouds. American hustle on the in-flight movie, catching more stairs than the mountaintops that will never bounce light just this way again. The story goes that even the astronauts played Hank Williams on Apollo 13 until the batteries died. And perhaps in the face of the possible fireball, all we know is the language we packed from home. Given one more minute, how many of us would opt for last words, some grand phrase to resolve up high what was left unfinished miles below? The fullest circle would be to go in silence, to let sky outlive the word for sky, and thrill one last time to what light and color gave, the outpost of ground and expansion of blue, and the promise that thoughts could help us climb.
That is Michael Miller reading Alaska Airlines Nonstop to LAX from his collection Tea and Subtitles, poems from 1999 to 2019. What year was this written?
That was written, I want to say, about 5 years ago. It came out in the book Angels in Seven, which was in 2016, so yeah. 2014 or 15.
I only ask that because I do think it's hard to fly now post 9/11 without some part of that being in your psyche of flying. And flying so miraculous anyway.
It is, yes.
That it works anyway, and that you're doing such mundane things while you're flying anyway. Mm-hmm. I think it's all weird. And, you've captured that so well of this, this idea that it's terrifying. And while it's terrifying, we're sitting here watching these, in-flight movies and mm-hmm. not paying attention to this miraculous thing that's going on all around us while it's happening. That's
good. Oh, for sure. I mean, it's true of so many things. Computers one time were unbelievable, and now they're these tiny little things in our pocket. When airplanes were invented, people would spend incredible amounts of money just to be able to fly on a plane. But now you go on a plane and the first thing you try to do is forget that you're on a plane. You know, you watch the in-flight movie, you read your magazine, you sleep, whatever it is. So, I mean, it's true of individual people and it's true of the human race. You know, wonder doesn't last. You know, there's that initial just thrill at something, you know, that discovery. It's kind of like what you were saying about adolescence a while ago. You know, something that happens when you're 15, you just process differently than when you're 30 or 40. And, you know, it's not that you get apathetic. It's just that, you know, your mind has changed. Your way of consuming things, if that's the best word, is different. So, yeah, it's very true of planes. It's true of cars. It's true of really just about anything you can name. Yeah, we do see things with different eyes, for sure, as we get older.
Yeah. And did you write this literally on the plane?
On the plane.
Okay. And do you find a phrase or a phrase that you hook into, like, as you were starting this before, I mean, the poem opens with "before the planes turn to ram the Twin Towers." Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that was sort of the first thing on your mind as you set pen to paper while you're sitting on the plane.
It was. Once in a while you write a poem that starts as free writing, and then when you're done, you realize that you really don't want to change very much at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this poem mostly came in one draft. I may have gone back and tweaked half a dozen words later on, but really I was sitting there, I had the notebook open, and I just wrote those lines that you just mentioned. It was the first thing that came to mind. And really, the rest of it flowed from there. Mm-hmm. So I think there are moments when you let down your guard, and you know, however it happens, it comes out exactly the way it's meant to be. But then there are other poems that take 2 years to write, so there's no rhyme or reason. Every poem just takes its own time and takes its own path toward completion.
Sometimes there's literally no rhyme nor reason in poems, which is great. So let's talk a little bit about how much you feel like people need to know. If you were going to go into poetry and you don't have an MFA and maybe you don't even have any background, you know, in English or any other writing, but you feel a compulsion to try your hand at poetry, how much information, knowledge, reading is necessary to have some sort of foundation to produce sort of competent poems?
In terms of how much, I mean, that's really an infinite amount. With poetry, you're never going to get to the bottom of it. So it's like music or painting or anything else. I mean, in a lifetime, you can never get to the bottom of everything. What I would say is, well, one thing is, when you go through school, obviously, you know, at some point you read Robert Frost, you read Emily Dickinson, you read Langston Hughes. The canon is given to you already, so, I mean, at very least, you do have that much. What I would say aside from that is really be omnivorous. You know, read great poets from the past. You know, D.H. Lawrence is one of my favorites. His book, Look, We Have Come Through, is one that I've read multiple times. So, you know, go back 100 years, go back 50 years, go back 6 months to something that got a great review in the L.A. Times. You know, read the one that got the Pulitzer Prize last year. Read the current Poet Laureate. So kind of be like a kid in a toy store. Just grab left and right. I don't think there's anything that's not going to inspire you one way or another. So really, it's taking in a lot and then, you know, constantly honing your own craft. You know, as you're reading those other people, keep writing your own stuff. You may not end up keeping all of it or even most of it, but you know, that's how your ideas develop. It's how your craft matures when you just keep putting yourself in contact with what other people have done. So, yeah, that's one piece of advice that I'll give to writers of any kind, but maybe especially poets. Don't let yourself be your only teacher. Mm. You know, when you're 18 or 19 years old and you're starting out, you know, you may know what you've learned in school. You have, you know, that much life experience behind you. Definitely there's something Emily Dickinson can tell you that you didn't know already. You know, there's something that Maya Angelou or Louise Glick, Billy Collins, you name it. You know, these people really are the masters of the craft. So you're going to learn a lot from them. So, you know, go into it, no matter how old you are, still thinking like a student. Never tell yourself that you're a genius. never tell yourself that you know everything, you know, that you have this whole poetry thing figured out, because you don't. And those people that I mentioned, you know, they don't either. They're still learning, no matter how many books they've written, you know, no matter how many prizes they may win, you know, they're still on that journey of discovery too. So, you know, learn from people who are ahead of you on the journey for sure, but never tell yourself that at some point you're just going to have it figured all out, because believe me, you never will. And that's why right. we keep writing. I mean, if it was that simple, then there wouldn't be much of a point to it. It's just so much about that process of discovery, you know, that process of discovering you, that process of discovering the world around you. I mean, it's exhilarating. You learn amazing things through writing poetry.
Yeah. Yes. You have a great exercise that you do with students or with people in your workshop of, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, of taking a poet, a well-known poet, reading them, and then they have to mimic something about that mm-hmm. poet. So, am I getting that right?
Correct. Yeah, at Our Lady of Lourdes Parish School in Northridge, there's a Catholic school in the Valley. Whenever we do a poem in class, we read a poem by another author, and we do an exercise where we follow up on the form and the content, by which I mean, for form, we look at a technique that the poet used. Maybe it's a certain rhyme scheme, maybe it's iambic pentameter, maybe it's a poem that has no punctuation. Stephen King talks about the writer's toolbox in his book mm-hmm. on writing. So poetry has a big toolbox. So one thing we do in those exercises, we use at least one tool that poet used in his or her piece. And the second is the subject matter. Like I mentioned, the Fishburger and Fries poem by Lowell Yeager. Again, that was the challenge. Write a poem that's about you just sitting there and observing. And it's never specific, like, you know, go to a McDonald's and write about what you see there. We talk about the broad idea that poet used. And then, you know, we want each student to, you know, go out of McDonald's, you know, take it in their own direction. So what I want to accomplish with those exercises is, number one, let students build their toolbox, which is important, but also get them thinking about the world in ways that they haven't before. What I tell my class sometimes is poetry is the art of discovering what you didn't know you knew. Hmm. And sometimes, you know, when you're given a challenge, you've read this poem by Lowell Yeager where he talks about the comings and goings in a fast food restaurant. Well, maybe you go to a place of your own. You might go to the mall or whatever it might be. And, you know, you sit there looking at those people. You're writing down observations about how people are dressed and how they're acting. And you might write a line that's really, really fascinating or really profound. And the thing is, that line was always inside you waiting to be brought out. Mm. I mean, ultimately, the poetry all comes out of you. So sometimes it's just reading that work by another poet or putting yourself in that mindset that poet did. And I mean, you could be amazed what you have inside you. My personal favorite poems are the ones that I didn't think I had in me to write.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether it's Mary Oliver or Christopher Buckley or whoever the poet is, they help to bring that out. And again, that's why it's so crucial, you know, not to just read your own work. You really do need to absorb other people's and see what you're really capable of doing.
Do you recommend sort of doing it by way of imitation at the beginning?
It's not a bad way to begin, but that definitely should be step one. There have been times, actually, where I've actually had another poem in front of me by a different writer, and I kind of have just imitated that poem. You know, I've structured the sentences the way they did and put all the line breaks in the same place. And in the course of doing that, sometimes I'll look at one or two lines and think, you know, I think the poem is going to come out of those. So then the original, kind of the carbon copy, that gets thrown away. And then you end up working on, you know, these two little interesting nuggets that you came up with. So, yeah, I mean, never let your tracks show that easily. But a lot of poems really start life in the middle of other poems. So, you know, this thing that started out as a rewrite of O Captain, My Captain might end up being something that doesn't even resemble O Captain, My Captain at all. It was Whitman's poem that helped you take the first step towards that other piece.
Yeah, yeah, it's nice to have the scaffolding, right?
Scaffolding is a good word.
Yeah, yeah. And it also might help people. I think there are two fears in poetry. Well, I have two fears about poetry, and I'll share them now.
Paper cuts.
Yes, paper cuts. Sentimentality, You know, that I feel like it's very easy to devolve into something precious, purple prose, something overly emotive or sentimental. That's one of my fears about if I were to write poetry, that's what would happen. And just, you know, a level of, I'm just not smart enough, or I just don't get it, or, you know, it's inaccessible to me. And I think that so many of the poets you've mentioned today, Sharon Olds and Louise Glick and all of these poets demonstrate you shouldn't have as many fears as you have, perhaps. Or, you know, you can read these people and feel rest assured that maybe you won't devolve into sentimentality so quickly or something. Especially if you imitate them a little bit at the beginning.
Of course. Yeah, in terms of sentimentality, I think you do need to be a really tough editor with yourself. So, yeah, I mean, if you see a poem getting mawkish or overly sentimental, that's when you tear it up and start over again. So you've got to be demanding with yourself. But in terms of not being smart enough, I mean, when you come down to it, poetry is language. I mean, it's words. You know, they're words that existed before any of us were born. We're just using them and putting them together in new ways. So I know what you mean about that fear. I mean, there are times when I find myself reading a book that I know is really acclaimed, and I just don't get it. You know, the next person it might click with beautifully, but for whatever, that line of communication, it's just not reaching me. But, I mean, I'm one reader. Does that mean the poet should go back and change his book? No. I mean, he wrote it the way he wanted to write it. Maybe someone else is his ideal audience. But, yeah, I mean, when people say they like poetry or they don't like poetry, I mean, it's kind of like saying, do you like food? You know, do you like music? Like, you know, all music, all food? So, yeah, I mean, every poet or every poetry reader has likes and dislikes. You know, some people love Emily Dickinson. Some people don't really get her. You know, for some people, Billy Collins is the best. For others, he might not be their favorite. So it's like everything. It's a matter of taste. So if people think, you know, I don't get poetry or I'm not smart enough, I would just say try another poet. I mean, there's so many out there. You know, maybe the one that you're reading right now just isn't the best fit for you. But, you know, as I remind my class, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox in which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. That's one of the most famous poems ever written by William Carlos Williams. So, you know, if that can be a world famous poem, you know, I think all of us get that. So, yeah, I would say if you're intrigued by the idea of poetry, just keep poking around and I'm sure you're going to find one that really does do it for you.
Well, and to that point, I also think there are certain times of your life when certain poets can mean more than others. I mean, you know, when you're in love, there's nothing better than Emily Dickinson here and there. And, you know, if you're suicidal, there's great poets for you. And, you know, I mean, I do encounter poets at the right time or not at the right time, depending on what I'm going through in life. And I can't say that's true to a degree in fiction, but not like it is in poetry. I mean, does speak to something in your soul a little closer.
Very much. Yeah, I think I mentioned Christopher Buckley a while back. One of my favorite poetry books of all time is his book Sky, which came out, I think, about 15 years ago. And I remember the first time I read that book, I was blown away by it. It's still one of my favorites. But I remember when I read it, I thought, I know there's a time earlier in life when I wouldn't have gotten this, because it's these existential poems, and they almost all of them, in one way or another, have to do with the sky. You know, he talks about the sky, the weather, the cosmos. He was, I don't know the exact age, but he's writing it from a middle-aged standpoint. Hmm. And again, when you're 18 or 19, it may not resonate with you the way it does later on. So I absolutely agree. The poems that you respond to say a lot about the person you are and, you know, in some cases, how different you are from the person you used to be.
Did that poem influence your flight poem, the Nonstop Flight? There's a lot of sky in there.
Maybe subconsciously. There's a poem in this book that was absolutely inspired by that book. It's called What We're Sure Of. And this poem, off the top of my head, I can't remember if there's actually a reference to sky, but that's a thing. Like, you know, Roger Ebert, the film critic, had a famous rule. He said, a movie is not about what it's about. It's about how it is about it. So with Christopher Buckley's book, I mean, it's about sky, but, you know, you can find any number of books about sky. It's how it is about the sky. It's what he does with it poetically, you know, spiritually, philosophically. And so this poem, What We're Sure Of, even though I don't think it's a sky poem, it's definitely connected with the kind of questions that he's asking in that book, the kind of feelings that he writes about. So, yeah, this one, I think, is a poem that was inspired a lot by him.
I'll read that.
Okay, so this is a three-part poem, What We're Sure Of, part one. The poet whose grandfather died a week ago hugs me and presses his card on the dim sum table to assure me that all orders today are on him. For 20 minutes, longer, he asks for nothing but stories, his arms folded on the table and head tilted forward as though attention, rapt focus, will buy some grace needed for later. My forced punchlines finally exhausted, he sighs, tearful, and shakes his head. Everything he knew is gone, he says. We picture memories, jokes, hard-won lessons slipping away. Earth takes the body, and heaven may admit the soul, but does the mind side with dust or ascension? Perhaps it floats in the middle, the leavings of gray matter swirling over tables here, in between scents and steam. Gone, for us, may just mean unreadable, too far for a voice or pen to set in code. So many others pass today, time and again, and each freeing of memory may have made the air thicker, the sun squeezing its way through clusters of particles, and there weighing just barely more on each shoulder. Did creation exist before we learned to imagine it? How slighter was the world before we gave it names? 2. Home to prepare for tutoring, and I'm relieved that knowledge is back in its physical bounds. The wooden CD case that I bought as a child, with the discs stacked in chronological order, creased books on the shelf nearby holding the stories behind each song. I am glad everything is in its place, but today the spines linger like unanswered telephones. No incentive to power the speakers or stretch to reach the top shelf when the gray matter recalls so much. Even still, I have my old self to thank. The 12-year-old who raced through homework, thrilled at the blank canvas of an open hour, and bent to listen on repeat to Bob Dylan sing A Hard Rain's A Gonna Fall, each throaty phrase and connection to the Cold War era adding to the stockpile of what could someday be cashed in. This week, the U.S. has mended walls with Cuba. 50 years coming, some say. The Iron Curtain looms elsewhere, and we still have the tunes for it. Meanwhile, rain keeps falling. On the road this morning, I watched a woman huddle with her cart at the bus stop while a plastic bucket gathered drops beside her. Each cupful will have its use, laundry or wipes or a boiling mug of tea, a source to ration. Our luck determines what we learn from rain. Part 3. At school now, and the girl assigned to me laughs. Mark Twain, the white light on her Kindle, and even the sober footnotes close enough to be funny. They call her an English learner, but that word applies to all of us. The definitions we gather and pass to others, never inventions of our own. She pauses at sever, the cousin of severe, and I sketch a flailing hand cleaved from the arm where it once belonged. If you sever a hand, I say, you have a severe injury. She smiles, tugs a sleeve over her fingers. Severe? Like serious? Like serious, yes, and in no time we'll both be serious again. This knowledge we carry, a talisman that does nothing on its own, a ticket merely to buy the food our stomachs cry for, an incantation against war and the storms that hammer on our roofs. So many things out to dissolve us. For what it's worth, we can classify them. The bell rings, and she jots sever in her binder. bows on her way to the door. One more word today, a new prize weightless and hidden, another piece of the trove assembled a blessing at a time.
That was Michael Miller reading What We Are Sure Of from his collection Tea and Subtitles, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Tell me about where that poem came from.
Where that poem came from, in the first section, there's that line, "Everything he knew is gone." That was actually inspired by a conversation I had with another poet. That poet's father had died. I made it a grandfather for the poem. But he was talking about just that. He said, you know, his father was a very smart man. He had many ideas. He knew so much. And I remember he said those exact words, "Everything he knew is gone." And that got me thinking, like, very literally about that question. Like, where does that go? Like, where do thoughts go? Where does knowledge go? I mean, we know, you know, the body is buried or cremated. If you believe in heaven, the soul goes up to heaven. But, you know, they talk about the mind, body, and soul. What happens to the mind? I mean, don't you ever wonder that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, all the thoughts that you have stored, all your memories, I mean, are they going to exist at all? Are they going to linger in the air? You know, do they join your body in the tomb? And so that statement that he made, it was such a literal statement, and kind of such a literal question, that it got me just thinking about how to answer it, and the rest of the poem really came out of there. But then again, it's a three-part poem, so it's one where you you kind of follow your own lead and see where it goes. So it got me thinking, you know, what do I know? What do I have stored? You know, I thought of those, you know, days years ago when I would listen to Dylan and I would read books about history, and I wanted to know so much. I felt like, you know, all of this is going to benefit me so much. Someday it's all going to pay off. And maybe it has, maybe it hasn't, but in any case, in section three, that was actually, we talked about true stories. This whole thing about talking with the English learner about sever and severe, every word in that part is true to life. I was tutoring, it was an English learner from China. She was reading Huckleberry Finn. And when we came to that word, she asked me to explain what sever meant. And so we got into this sever, you know, severe injury. She thought that was kind of funny. So, and then I just realized, you know, if my knowledge is going to pay off, you know, for the rest of the world, probably this is how it's going to happen. You know, I'm just going to pass it on to this teenage girl who has to know what severe means. And so, you know, at the end of the poem, at the end of that tutoring session in real life, well, she knew one more word, and that's certainly better than nothing. So, you know, she's building her stockpile of knowledge, too, and, you know, years from now, who knows where that might go as well.
And you get to play with how fun the English language is to play with and learn with, and how bizarre it is.
English is a very bizarre language.
Yeah, yes. Right. It also harkens to the third poem in the collection. It's called "The Chicago Window Washer Lets His Soap Painting Stay."
Yes.
And the very opening of that poem is, "If the cable snaps today, his ideas will not go with him," which is kind of the same idea, right?
Yeah. And in fact, that poem and the one that we just read, What We're Sure Of, those were both in the same book, Angels in Seven. That book, it begins with the one you just mentioned, "The Chicago Window Washer Lets His Soap Painting Stay." A few poems in is "What We're Sure Of." And then the last one is "Alaska Airlines Nonstop to LAX." So again, my little Valentine poetically to Christopher Buckley. There's a lot of sky in that book. Yeah. So the book begins with, it begins and ends with characters suspended in the air. The opening lines are, "If the cable snaps today, his ideas will not go with him," talking about one of these window washers who, you know, dangle themselves down on cables to wash skyscrapers. And then the last poem obviously is about being on a plane, having this little memory of 9/11. So that book begins and ends with people suspended in midair. And there's a lot of air and sky and cosmos in between. So, the connection that you drew there is very true.
That's really interesting. So tell me about putting this collection together and choosing the poems that would make it up. Because, you know, poems have to stand on their own, but they also have to stand in conversation with each other. And I'd just love to hear your process for selecting.
That's really it. You want the best poems. Selected poems is kind of like a musician putting together your greatest hits. So you want to have the best, but you want to make sure that they work as standalone pieces. some people have asked if there had been a 51st poem in the book, what would it have been? The last one that I cut was one called First Bedroom, which is in the book, mm-hmm. The First Thing Mastered. And like I mentioned, that's a book that, it's a very thematic book. It goes chronologically through the first 30 or 35 years of life. And that one, First Bedroom, it's a poem that I'm very fond of. To me, it wasn't quite enough of a standalone poem. Like, it makes references to poems that appear earlier in that book. And so, when I took it out of the context, I didn't feel like it really worked as a single, so to speak. So for that reason, I ended up leaving that one out. But yeah, for the other ones, it's really those two things that you said. You want them to be, you know, first rate, but they really have to work outside the context of the books that they were originally in. And also with this book, the poems, they're sequenced not in the order that they were published. Like sometimes with a collection like this, you just do the earliest one and then chronologically, you know, you work until the most recent. I opted not to do that for this one just because, the fact that they're chronological doesn't necessarily mean that they flow that way.
Right.
So, for that reason, I just looked for, cohesion. So, you know, the poems here, they go back and forth throughout the 20 years. There were poems that were in those books. There were ones that were just in magazines. So, really, it just came down to which poem is best going to follow that one that came before it. So that was really the decision-making process.
And the juxtapositions are so nice. We don't have time to read them today, but the in the center of the collection, there's a poem called Birth, and juxtaposed next to, on the facing page, a poem called Grandfather, which, you know, really speaks to the beginning of life and the end of life, and it has really wonderful references to soldiers in both poems, little toy soldiers versus the grandfather having been a soldier. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this wonderful pleasure that the reader gets from cross-referencing things that, you know, obviously the poems, as you say, have to stand alone, but reading them across poems is really, really incredibly powerful, too, and that's really fun. I can't believe we're drawing down on our time. We've gone totally over. But I would like to end with the first poem in the collection. There's so many wonderful New Year's poems in here, and you know, the show is running on New Year's Day. So I had wanted to get to a lot of those, but in your leisure time, dear listener, pick up the collection. There's some really wonderful sort of meditations on new beginnings and New Year's, and there's a January 1st poem in here. Mm. But the first poem in the collection is called Newborn, and there are a couple of lovely things about it, but I'll let you read it first, and then we can talk about it.
Okay, great. This is actually the last poem in The First Thing Mastered, so Newborn. It starts with an illumination, the brightest there will ever be. The darkness pierced at the end of the bubble, and the sudden holocaust of white. The dreams welled up and carried surging into slap of air and quaking breath. This box of four walls and a ceiling, bounding the new outrageous world, of hands that pass to larger hands, and colors teeming in every corner. The only light that will rush in, without the memory of light before. The cord cut, and then the moments lift, before the glide into expectant arms, the first taste of effortless flight, and the first fleeting touchdown.
I love that that is the first poem here and the last poem the last time. That's really lovely.
The First Thing Mastered, see, originally this was the first poem in that book too. The reason that I moved it was I realized that even though it's about a newborn, it's written from an adult's point of view, because it has all this perspective, you know, this is the brightest illumination there will ever be, there will never be light like this again. When you're a newborn, you don't know those things. So the First Thing Mastered, it actually begins with a poem called Waking that, I mean, to the extent that an adult writer can even do this, it's about what the world looks like or may look like from a newborn's point of view, you know, just this kind of baffling world, and these, who are these people, what is this room? And then gradually in the first section of that book, things start making sense. They start getting more recognizable. So this actually became the last poem in the book. It kind of cycles back to the beginning. It's just now we have infancy with perspective. So for that book, it ended up being the last poem, but for this one, again, just going back to flow and cohesion, when it came down to which poem is going to open the selected poems, this was a very easy choice.
And you said this is the one that deviated the most from what you thought it was going to be when you started writing it?
Yeah, like I said a while ago, some poems kind of begin in the middle of other poems. I can't even remember exactly what I was writing, but it was just kind of this long, rambling thing that had something to do with childbirth. And it's one of those things where you get to the third page, and, I mean, you can't even tell where you've started or where you're going with this. Mm-hmm. So I pushed it aside for a moment and just thought, okay, childbirth. Just write something about childbirth. And so I ended up cutting probably, I don't know, like the number of words that I cut from the poem were probably like four times what actually made it into the poem. But yeah, sometimes, again, you have to just kind of work through it and lead yourself to the right space. So kind of when I had cut through all that thicket of stuff that didn't end up getting used, yeah, these lines just came out. And yeah, I realized it was as simple as they are, because it is a relatively simple poem. There really wasn't anything that I wanted to add, so I let it just be a nice, concise poem and let it go with that.
Let it go with that. I love the phrase Holocaust of White.
Thank you.
That really has stayed with me seemingly words that don't go together, that you don't quite understand what they mean, that just stay with you, that talk to some other part of your brain. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you came up with those or if it's... Who knows, right?
Yeah, I think that is the hardest question to answer. How did you come up with that?
How did you come up? Yeah, right.
Again, it's somewhere inside you. Yeah. It's somewhere inside you waiting to be birthed. So
that's the pleasure, yes. Is fine, as you say, is discovering what all the multitudes that are contained within you that you had no idea until you wrote them down. It's really fun. This was a huge pleasure. Is there any last minute words of writing advice that we should? Or places, I want to mention that we can find you at the LA Times Festival of Books that's coming up this coming April. You're going to be on the stage?
Yes, correct.
That's great. That's great. And should we mention anything else? Writing advice? Or
Writing advice.
Never easy, but always.
Yeah. How much time? Do we have another hour or 2 hours?
I know, right?
I'm a teacher. I can go on.
You can go on forever.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the last advice I can give is, you know, have fun with it to the degree that you can. I mean, I know the subject matter may not be upbeat, but whatever it is, nobody has to make art of any kind. You know, you do it because you have the desire to, you do it because you have this idea that you really think is going to move or resonate with other people. So I mean, if you find yourself really getting stuck, then find a way to loosen yourself up, you know, write a silly poem, write a parody of one of your other poems, whatever it is. Sometimes when you let down your guard, it's amazing, again, just those ideas that you can stumble upon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, be loose, have fun, and, you know, just tell yourself that even if you're stuck right now, you're not going to be stuck forever. You'll get out of it.
I love it. Michael Miller, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Thanks for driving down. That was wonderful. The book, Tea and Subtitles, Selected Poems from 1999 to 2019, is out and available now. Michael has a website. I put it up on Facebook, and I will put it up with our podcast, but you can find him there. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.